Okay, there we go. Well, last week we discussed a little bit chapter 20, the longest chapter in 1 Samuel. It's a painful chapter. It's almost as if chapter 20, God is expressing the pain that's in his heart when David and Jonathan part ways. These two men who loved one another, almost like they shared a common soul, yet they parted ways, never to see each other again. And it's because of hatred without a cause, as we discussed a couple weeks ago. And I asked myself, why did God spend so much time on this chapter, giving so much detail about this event? And it's almost as if it echoes the pain that's in God's heart when he saw Messiah and the people who followed him, and the ripping that took place between Messiah and his followers and greater Israel. It's almost like you sense the agony in God's heart because of this ripping, this tearing, this thing that should not have happened, but it happened because of hatred without a cause. Well, we come to chapter 21 and we follow David. And we see him fleeing from Saul. And if you've read, you know what the major points in this story are. In chapter 21, it starts with David arose and left, and Jonathan came back to the city. And they will never see each other again. And David comes to Nob, to Ahimelech the Kohen. He's the high priest. And he comes to the Kohen and tells him a lie. And we're going to discuss this a little bit later in the lesson. Because you'll notice there's several people who have been telling lies in this story. David's wife, Michal, lies to her father Saul about where David is and what has happened. Jonathan lies to his father Saul. David's hiding down in the field, but Jonathan tells his father, oh, David had to go back to Bethlehem. There's a big party, big reunion or whatever. It was a lie. We see David lying a couple of times. We see him telling a lie here to the high priest. And later on, when he comes to Gath, he lies because he acts insane when he's really not insane. In fact, throughout Scripture, we see people telling lies, getting away with it, and often even getting rewarded for it. Now, how do you explain that? Well, we have time, we'll get to that. But he tells in verse 3, David said to Ahimelech the Kohen, the king ordered me on a mission, that's not true, and told me, no man may know anything about the matter for which I have sent you and commanded you. That wasn't true either. Thus I informed my attendants to be at a certain secret place. And so he asked him for some food, and Ahimelech says, well, the only thing I have is the showbread that's kept in the tabernacle here. It's the only thing I've got. And David said, well, give it to me. And they talk about it, and the priest gives it to him. Yeshua cites this. He even cites this event later on in the Gospel of John, if I'm not mistaken. So David gets the food, and he also takes Goliath's sword, because it's been stored there at the tabernacle. He takes that with him, because he doesn't even have a weapon. And then we go on, and in verse 11, David arose and fled from Saul on that day, came to Achish, king of Gath. The servants of Achish said to him, is this not David, the king of the land? Is it not of him that they sing with a timbrel, saying, Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands? So some people say, this is David, this is the king, this is the hero of Israel. But others say, oh no, he's a madman, he's crazy. Kick him out of here. That can't be the king. And then we come to chapter 22. We see David gathering people around him. And what kind of men come to him? Well, we see it. 400 men gather around him, it says in verse 2. With him were about 400 men. And then it tells us what kind of men. I find this fascinating. If you go down a little bit further, if you go to verse 2, rather, it says they gathered to him every man in distress, every man with a creditor, everyone who is in debt, and every man embittered of soul. Keep that in mind, the kind of men who gathered themselves to David. They weren't the elite of society. They were the ones that society would call the washouts, the losers, the dregs of society, the nobodies. And then the scene shifts to Saul. And what's Saul doing? Self-pity. Self-pity, just feeling sorry for himself. Sitting under a tree and he thinks everybody's against him. David's against him. He believes Jonathan is against him. He accuses his servants of plotting and keeping secrets from him. You know, the person who is in sin, the person who's living in rebellion from God, lives in constant fear. They may try to cover it up with this or that, but they live in constant fear, constant paranoia, because they feel the world is out to get them. Because you see, the joy of the Lord is our strength. And when that joy of the Lord is gone, we don't have strength. We feel as weak as water. And this is how Solomon, or how Saul is feeling. And as you read through this account of what Saul says, it's all about me, me, me. You got to count how many times he says me in this. And then there's Doeg the Edomite. He was there when Elimelech, the high priest, gave David the showbread and gave him Goliath's sword. And Doeg goes and reports this to Saul. And Saul is outraged by this, and so he tells his servants, you go get Elimelech and his entire family, and you bring him in here, and I want you to kill them. But his servants won't do it. So Doeg does it for him. Doeg kills all 85 people. 85 people. Interesting thing about that number 85. It kind of jumped out at me. Usually when the scriptures give you a specific number, it's for a specific reason. Because there's something the scriptures want to teach. And if you know your Hebrew alphabet, you'll know what letters make up the word or the letter or the number 85. The letter pe equals 80. And the letter he equals 5. That makes a total of 85. And my Hebrew scholars, what does the word pay mean? Mouth. Isn't that interesting? The writer of Samuel knew there was a connection here, so he gives us the specific number, so we make that connection. Doeg's mouth cost 85 lives. 85 people died because of one man's mouth. Maybe this is what James had in mind when he talked about how the mouth is so dangerous. It's a fire. It's like a sword that just it can slay and kill so many. We talked about the Holocaust a little bit during the prayer service. What was Hitler's number one weapon? His speech, his mouth. What's Satan's only weapon? His mouth. A serpent has one weapon. He doesn't have arms, doesn't have legs. He has a mouth. The only weapon he's got. So keep that in mind whenever you think of Doeg and the priests that were killed. I was stunned when I thought, here's Saul, who God commanded to slay all the Amalekites. Remember that? But Saul had pity on the Amalekites. And eventually, one of these Amalekites had pity on became the ancestor of Haman in the book of Esther, who tried to wipe out all the Jews. So here's Saul, he's reluctant to carry out God's orders against Amalek. Yet on the other hand, he's willing to kill David, the anointed king. He's willing to kill his own son, Jonathan. Remember, he throws a spear at him. And here he kills the high priest and his entire family. Something's really upside down in this man's life. But there's a lesson here. If you're not destroying in your life a thing God says to destroy, that thing will use you. Destroy others. It always happens that way. How many families have been destroyed because there was a character flaw, a lust? There was something destructive in the father's life that the father did not deal with. And as a result, that lust destroyed his family. How many times in the mother's life, the wife's life, there is something that may have to do with lust or with gossip or with whatever. And God says, you need to destroy this thing in your life. But they failed to destroy that residual Amalek in their life. And as a result, that thing destroys their relationships, destroys their family, destroys the ones who love them best. We need to be very careful about the things that God commands us to destroy and we leave alive in our lives. Because if we don't destroy them, they will rise up to destroy everything around us. But the reason I'm going through these things, I want you to have a picture of some of the events in these two chapters. Because as we go through these, you're going to find that the events in David's life parallel events in Yeshua's life. And we shouldn't be surprised at this. After all, the scriptures constantly refer to Yeshua as the Son of David. In our very first week of study, we talked about Son of David doesn't just mean that he's a direct descendant of David, which he was. But to be the son of someone means you are like that person. Paul refers to Timothy as his son. Why? Timothy wasn't David, wasn't Paul's son. But he was his son in the faith. In other words, Timothy teaches the way I teach. Timothy holds valuable what I hold to be valuable. Timothy hates what I hate. He understands the scriptures the way I understand the scriptures. So listening to Timothy and relating to Timothy is like relating to me. You understand? This is why people who walk in the steps of Abraham are called children of Abraham. A convert to Judaism is always referred to as a ben Avraham, a son of Abraham. Why? Because they've done what Abraham did. Abraham was a Gentile. He heard God's voice. He obeyed him. And God counted to him as righteousness. And we are called upon to do the very same thing. And Paul tells us that we are children of Abraham if we've walked in his steps. We are over here. God calls us. And something in our heart says yes. And we respond to it. And we follow God. So Yeshua is a son of David. But there's more to it than that. We'll also see that the events in David's life and the events in Yeshua's life are very parallel to one another in some amazing, amazing ways. But before we look at these, one other thing I want you to get. In Hebraic thought, a king and a kingdom are one. The words are the same. A king and a kingdom are one. No king, no kingdom. No kingdom, no king. You have one, you have the other. And in Hebraic thought, in God's economy, the king's experience is the country's experience. And the experience of the people is the experience of the king. They walk parallel paths. They experience life together. This is why when you look at the life of Yeshua, you'll notice that it parallels the life of Israel. Israel was in Egypt and called out of Egypt. Yeshua, as an infant, was taken to Egypt, called out of Egypt. When Moses was born, Pharaoh tried to have all the baby boys killed. When Yeshua was born, Herod tried to have all the baby boys killed. They both lived in regimes that were very oppressive. Moses was a shepherd, who was a prince, who became a shepherd, who became a leader of Israel. Yeshua is the King of Kings, who becomes a shepherd, who becomes a leader of Israel. That means we can go on and on and on with this. And if you take the life of David, you'll see a lot of parallels between David and Israel. If you take Israel's history and David's history, you also see a lot of parallels. And I wish we had time to look at all of these, but we're going to look at the parallels between David and Yeshua. Let's start. First of all, they're both born in Bethlehem, the city of David. Bethlehem, the house of bread. Yeshua, the bread of life, is born in a feed trough, a manger, in a town called House of Bread. I think God's trying to emphasize something with that. They were both shepherds. We know about David being the shepherd. We think, wait a minute, Yeshua, he was a carpenter. A carpenter or a stonemason. We don't know which the word means, but he was a builder. But in John 10:11, Yeshua says, refers himself, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. They both lived in an oppressive regime. David lived under a king who was out to get him. Yeshua lived under a king and also a religious order whose leadership was out to get him. They both loved someone named Jonathan. David loved Jonathan. They entered into a covenant together. And John, five times in the Gospel of John, or Yochanan, as his Hebrew name would be, his Greek form of his Hebrew name, is called the disciple whom Yeshua loved. There's a special love relationship between Yeshua and John, or Yochanan. They both mean the gift of God. They are gracefully given by God. Their names mean the same. Both are persecuted by Saul. David was persecuted by King Saul. And in Acts chapter 9, there's a man named Saul who's going out to persecute the followers of Yeshua. And God just kind of flicks, I guess, picture his hand coming out and going like you do to a mosquito or something. He just knocks him off his horse. But that's just me. He fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to him, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" So he said, "Who are you, Lord?" He replied, "I am Yeshua, whom you are persecuting." So David's persecuted by Saul. Yeshua is persecuted by a man named Saul, both of the tribe of Benjamin. The differences between these two Sauls is this, though. The Saul here in the book of Samuel started off as a godly man, a humble man, a servant, who turned wicked. But the Saul in the New Testament started off as a wicked man out to crush the son of David and his followers, who turned around and became a man of great blessing, and a man who is a great leader in the early days of the Messianic community. You know, I love to look at the two stories together, because then Saul, the Old Testament, has a happy ending. You know, I just believe it's part of the same story in some way. They're both tested in the wilderness. So many of the Psalms of David were written in the desert, written in the wilderness under persecution, when his enemy is after him. He's thirsty out there. We'll be reading later on about how he thirsted. You know, often they were hungry and alone, feeling like the world was against them. Israel was tested in the wilderness. David is tested in the wilderness. And Yeshua was tested in the wilderness. And Matthew chapter 4, we're told about how the Spirit, after Yeshua's immersion, led him up into the wilderness to be tempted, to be tested. The same word in Greek, tempt and test, are the same word, to be tested of the devil. We read in our chapter how we just read about how David ate a holy bread, the showbread, which is only for the priest, but it was given to David. Yeshua did the same. When you read in Matthew about Yeshua's temptation, it tells you that after he countered the devil, it says, "Then the devil left him, and angels came and began ministering to his needs." Well, what was his number one need? He was starving to death, and they brought food to him. This is pretty amazing. Now think about it. Israel is tested in the wilderness, and what did they eat? Bread from heaven. David is tested, and what did he eat? The showbread from the tabernacle, the holy bread. Yeshua is tested in the wilderness, and what does he eat? Bread from heaven. You see these parallels here? Israel, King David, and a son of David, the ultimate one to whom all of this points. They eat heavenly bread. They're both thought to be crazy. We just read about how David would feigned insanity when he was there in front of King Achish. But what did they say about Yeshua? In John 8:48, it says, "The Judeans replied, 'Aren't we correct in saying that you are a Samaritan and are possessed by a demon?'" And then later, a couple chapters later, John chapter 10, this is during the festival of Sukkot. Verse 20, it says, "Many of them were saying, 'He's possessed by a demon and has lost his mind. Why do you listen to him?' But others said, 'These are not the words of someone possessed by a demon. A demon cannot cause the blind to see, can it?'" I remember when David was in Achish, some people said, "This is the king, this is the hero, this is David." And others said, "Ah, he's nuts, he's insane." They couldn't make up their mind on David. They had trouble making up their mind about Yeshua. Interesting, isn't it? Now you think, well, wait a minute, Yeshua didn't feign insanity. No, he didn't. But he did hide his glory from the people. Think of Yeshua just descended out of heaven and a beam of light and come down in the eyes of all Israel. In fact, that's how he's going to return. But what if he'd come that way the first time? Do you think there'd been any persecution, any rejection, any question about who he was? No. When he came the first time, He came incognito. He didn't act insane. But he sure didn't act like what they expected a king of Israel to act like either. You know what I mean? He hid who he was because he wanted us to know in our hearts and recognize him from the inside out. The first time he came, he's recognized with the eyes of the Spirit. When he returns, every eye will behold him. We'll all see him with the eyes of the flesh. I love the language there in 1 Samuel 20, verse 19. And we looked at this briefly last week, but look at it again. And make sure your translations are correct, because I found all the different translations render this in various and sundry ways. But in 1 Samuel 20, verse 19, Jonathan is giving David counsel, and he says, "For 3 days you are to remain far down." Now he's saying far down in the field by the Ezel stone that we talked about last week. But that phrase, spend 3 days far down. And what does Yeshua do? What does he say? He says, "I will give them the sign of Jonah, who spent 3 days in the belly of the earth. And just like he spent 3 days there, the Son of Man will spend 3 days, 3 nights in the earth." They both experienced hatred without a cause. We find that phrase for the first time in 1 Samuel 20, verse 19. No, I don't either. That's not the right one. I put down the wrong reference. Scratch that reference. But David is talking to Jonathan earlier in the chapter, and he says that they have hated me. Saul has hated me without a cause. We did a whole study on it. I don't know why I can't find it right now. But if you find it, you might find it real quick. Pardon me? It should be in chapter 20. I thought I had it underlined here. Oh, well, we'll come back to it later. But David is talking to Jonathan about how Saul has hated him without a cause. Maybe it's in chapter 19. Yes, it's in chapter 19. In verse 5. "So why should you send with innocent blood to kill David for no reason?" This is Jonathan speaking. And earlier on, it says, well, this is embarrassing, but you know I'm used to it. Why can't I find that phrase where David talks about Saul having hated him without a cause? 19:5. Thank you. Wonderful. Thanks a lot. Well, that's where he talks about killing him for no reason. But there's one where he hates him for no reason. I'm looking for that particular phrase. Oh, well. Get the tape from a couple weeks ago. It's there. It's there somewhere. But in John 15:25, Yeshua quotes this. Says, "But they have done this to fulfill the word that is written in their Torah. They hated me without a cause." Remember, we looked at the Talmud. We read some portions from the Talmud where the rabbis are discussing, why was the temple destroyed? And the answer they give is hatred without a cause. That's incredible. Hatred without a cause. And what did this hatred of David without a cause, what did it lead to? Saul's hatred for David, what did it result in? The destruction of the priest and the tabernacle. What did the hatred of Yeshua without a cause lead to? The destruction of the priesthood and the temple in 70 AD. You see all of the parallels? Pretty incredible, huh? So what does David do as he flees from Saul? He goes among the Gentiles. He goes among the Philistines. We see there as we read. But then later he goes to Moab. He takes his family to Moab. Let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 21. Near the end of chapter 21. I'm sorry, chapter 22. Near the end of chapter 22. Verse verse 3, near the beginning of chapter 22. Thank you. David went from there to Mizpah of Moab, and he said to the king of Moab, "Let my father and mother come out here and be with you until I know what God will do with me." There's a picture of exile going on here. David and his family are, in a sense, exiled, because in ancient times, when you went after a man, you went after his family as well. Because you figured, if I kill this guy, and I don't kill his family, one of his kids is going to come back later and kill me. So it's best to get all of them. And that's how Saul thought. And so when David fled, it was important to take mom and dad, his brothers, his sisters, all of his family, and get them all out, because he knew Saul would come after all of them. So he goes to Moab. There's exile. What happened after the destruction of the temple to Israel? Exile. But how did Moab treat David's family? Now, the scriptures don't tell us specifically how Moab treated his family. It says as long as David was there, they treated him well, treated the family well. And that's all we have in the scriptures. But when we read in Bamidbar Rabbah, this is part of the Midrash Rabbah, is a commentary, an ancient commentary, thousands of years old, on the book of Numbers. This is what it says. I'll quote it to you directly. It says, "When David fled from Saul, he took his father and mother to the king of Moab, for he was descended from Ruth the Moabitess." We all know that Ruth the Moabitess was like the great-grandmother of David. Now, the Midrash, as most Jewish literature does, it jumps from one thing to the other, and immediately calls up a verse, a phrase in Psalm 60, verse 8, where David writes, Moab is a pot. It's a pot. Now, why do you call a country a pot? And so they bring in this commentary. It says, "The reason why David called Moab a pot is this: as flesh is consumed in a pot, so were his relatives, his family, consumed there. For the king of Moab slew them, and not one of them escaped, except a brother of David who fled." Now, that's not in the scriptures, but it's in the ancient Jewish histories and Jewish commentary. So we don't know exactly if it's true or not, but in the Jewish mind, who is very familiar with the Midrash Rabbah, to them, they believe that Moab wiped out David's family, except for one brother. Now, here's what's so fascinating. Are you ready for this? Moab liked David, and Moab took care of the family as long as David was there. But they didn't really like David's family. Apply that to today. Among the Gentiles, they like Jesus. And they tolerate Jews to a degree because they like Jesus. But when they forget about who Jesus really is, they're ready to wipe out the family of Yeshua. When you think about the Holocaust and the Nazis, do you know most of the Nazis considered themselves Christians? They did. They are primarily Catholics or Lutherans. They considered themselves Christians. And the swastika was a form of the cross. In fact, originally the swastika had a Christian cross in the middle, but later over time, Hitler had that removed, where it's just the swastika shape. Now, no true Christian has ever persecuted a Jew. But in the name of Christianity, the name of Christendom, terrible things have been done. Terrible things have been done. So just like, how can Moab love David and hate his family enough to wipe them out? How can people, Gentiles, say they love Jesus? They want to wipe out the people of Jesus. It's like that poem I've quoted before. I'll probably muff it this time. It says, "How odd of God to choose the Jews, but odder still are those who choose a Jewish God and hate the Jews." You know, that kind of sums it up, doesn't it? And then what kind of people were attracted to David? We read it. Let's read it again. 1 Samuel 22, verse 1. What kind of people came to David, went into exile with him, were willing to suffer persecution with David? Verse 2, they gathered to him every man in distress. What kind of people go to Yeshua? People in distress. People who are at the end of their ropes. Usually Yeshua is not the first choice people make. Usually their last choice, then best. Also, every man with a creditor, every man who's in debt. Boy, that's every one of us. Maybe not financially, but spiritually, every one of us is a pauper. Every one of us is in debt. God has given us life. He's given us time on this earth. And like a prodigal son, every one of us, to some degree or other, wastes what God has given us. And we are in God's debt and no way to pay it. We owe a debt of sin and no way to pay that debt. And yet Yeshua pays it for us. And it says, and every man embittered of nefesh, embittered of soul. They're depressed. They're unhappy. They're sad. Life is miserable for them. These are the kind of people who find their hope in Yeshua. As I was reading this, I was reminded of 1 Corinthians chapter 1. Passage you're all familiar with, probably. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 26 to 28. This is what Paul writes. For consider your calling, brethren, that there were not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble. But God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. And God's chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things which are strong. And the base things of the world and the despised God has chosen. The things that are not, so they may nullify the things that are. Kind of the same kind of description, isn't it? Same kind of people. I heard one person tell me there's only one thing about us that God finds attractive. Our need. Isn't that something? Why should God be attracted to me? Because you need. Because he came to seek and to save that which is lost. And by finding you, encountering you, gives him purpose. See? No lost sheep. What does he have to do? He came to seek and to save that which is lost. And he does a great job of it, too. I often think, forgive me if I've shared this with you not too long ago, but I've been in church meetings and prayer meetings and Bible studies, and someone will stand up and talk about so-and-so found the Lord, or last week I found the Lord. And anymore I hear that, it just makes me laugh inside. I know what they mean, but what they're saying is really ridiculous. Because the Lord wasn't the one who was lost. They didn't find him. They've been running from him all their lives. He's been chasing them down all their lives. They just finally gave up and surrendered. So there's nothing about us finding the Lord. That's ridiculous. He's not lost. We are. He has sought us out to seek us and to save us. There's a wonderful poem called The Hound of Heaven. And it may sound demeaning, but it's talking about the Holy Spirit of God is like the Hound of Heaven. He's on your trail. He's not losing your scent, and he's going to run you to ground. You're going to get tired long before he ever even thinks about getting tired. He doesn't get tired. And he will finally run you to ground. But when you're exhausted, when you've reached the end of your strength, and you totally give up, you have nothing to lose, you turn around and you find he wasn't chasing you down to crush you, to condemn you, to kill you, to make you miserable, to judge you, to criticize you. He was there to give you his strength. He was there to give you what is his. He was coming to adopt you into his Father's family. If only we quit believing the lies that he tells us about the Lord, we'd all do a lot better. Do you see here with this list? I'm sure there are more I'm missing, but isn't this an amazing list of the things so far we've seen in David's life that parallel the life of Yeshua? No wonder he's called the Son of David. Because his life is so very similar. So very similar. And 1 Samuel is kind of a picture of Yeshua's first coming. Because we see David on the run, attacked, persecuted, tested, hungry, thirsty. You know, with the people that nobody wants, the ones who are following him. When we come to 2 Samuel, it's a picture of Yeshua's second coming. Because now he's coronated as the king. Now he's leading an army that's purifying the land. You see? So 1 and 2 Samuel are like the first and second coming of Yeshua. And by looking at these two books, we get a well-rounded picture of Yeshua's program in this world. Isn't that amazing? This doesn't happen by coincidence. No man is smart enough to figure this out. Say, I want to write this book. And then hope that 2,000 years or 1,000 years from now that the Messiah is born and it actually looks like this. You know, you just don't do that. Only God, who runs the world, who has the end and the beginning both right there in his hand, who's directing the script and making things happen according to his will, only that can explain these kinds of wondrous things we see in God's Word. Nothing else explains it. Well, let's talk about blessed liars, blessed deceptions. You know, I've thought about this a lot, but I don't teach on it because I don't understand it. But I'm going to give you what little bit of insight I have. And I don't claim to understand it altogether. But it's something in the Scriptures that stares us in the face over and over and over again. I call them blessed deceptions. And I put a question mark. Because some of them weren't so blessed. But some of them were. And what's the difference? What's the principle underlying this whole thing? One of the commandments is, thou shalt not bear false witness. And yet I'm seeing people blessed all over the place for doing just that. Bearing false witness. So how does that work? How is that not a violation of the commandment? Now, the sages say this commandment has to do with being in a court of law, where you have honest men, unbiased men, trying to delve into the truth and learn the facts. And in that case, you always tell the plain, unadorned truth. All the truth and nothing but the truth. But the sages say, but outside that context, sometimes it's necessary not to tell the truth. Like when your wife asks, does this dress make you look fat? You know? It's one of those times where you break the commandment to save a life. You see? But there are a number of examples in Scripture. Let's look at them in order. These are a few, and I'm sure you'll think of others. I'm thinking of Rachel and Jacob. Remember how Jacob, the second born, wants the birthright that belongs to Esau. So, Isaac tells Esau, go out and kill some game. You know how I like it, the way you cook it. Get some fresh deer or whatever it is and cook it up the way you know how to cook it up, and you give me this great meal and I'm going to give you the blessing. All right? Rachel overhears this and she says, Jacob, your dad's about to give the blessing to your older brother Esau. But I want you to have the blessing. And God prophesied that you would have the blessing. So listen, go put on your brother's stinky clothes. And your brother's real hairy, so put some goat's hair on the back of your arms and hands and around the back of your neck. And since Isaac's blind, he'll think it's Esau, and he'll give you the blessing. Oh, come on, I mean, this is just really underhanded. How do you excuse this? But Jacob got the blessing. When we come to Exodus, the first chapter, we read the story of Shiphrah and Puah, who are the midwives. Israel's in Egypt. They're in slavery. Pharaoh commands the midwives, when a baby boy is born, a Jewish boy is born, throw him in the Nile River. Well, Shiphrah and Puah, they disobeyed him. And they lied to him. And it says the midwives feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them. They let the boys live. Then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and said to them, why have you done this and let the boys live? Listen to what they say. The midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. For the Hebrew women are vigorous. They give birth before the midwives get to them. Yeah, right. So why do we have midwives, you know? So God treated the midwives well. You see, they lied to Pharaoh, and God treated these midwives well. And the people multiplied, became very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he made households for them. They got blessed for lying. Rahab, she's praised one end of the Bible the other. Here she is a harlot who lives in Jericho. And the two spies come to Jericho, and she hides them. right? And it says there that the policemen of Jericho, or whatever they were, they came to her and said, "We saw two men come in here. Where are they?" And the woman hid the two men and replied, "Yes, these men were clients of mine, but I didn't know where they came from." She knew where they were from. "When it was time to shut the city gates for the night, the men left." I don't know where they were heading. "Chase after them quickly, for you have time to catch them." Now she had taken them up to the roof and hidden them in the stalks of flax she had spread out on the roof. There was not one word of truth in anything she said. And yet, we find Rahab in the ancestry of Yeshua when you read in Matthew. You read his ancestry. And there's Rahab right there. This Canaanite harlot from Jericho. And Hebrews 11:31 praises her. It says, "By faith, Rahab the prostitute escaped the destruction of the disobedient because she welcomed the spies in peace." And James 2:25. "And similarly, was not Rahab the prostitute also justified by works when she welcomed the messengers and sent them out by another way?" You could say she's justified by works for what she did for the spies, but she should have been condemned for the sin of lying. But it doesn't say anything about her lying. It praises her for what she did. Jael. Now here's a woman you want to keep an eye on. Judges 4, verses 17 to 21. Here she is, she's in her tent. And Sisera, who is the enemy captain, the enemy general, and they're chasing after him to kill him because they've had this war and Sisera's army's left. So they're after Sisera to do him in. Sisera ran away on foot to the tent of Jael, wife of Heber the Kenite, for King Jabin of Hazor and the family of Heber the Kenite had made a peace treaty. Jael came out to welcome Sisera. She said to him, "Stop and rest, my lord. Stop and rest with me for a really, really, really long time." Yeah, you could add in. "Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid." So Sisera stopped to rest in her tent. She put a blanket over him. He said to her, "Give me a little water to drink because I'm thirsty." She opened a goatskin container of milk and gave him some milk to drink. Betty bye, nighty night. Sleep tight. Then she covered him up again. He said to her, "Stand watch at the entrance to the tent. If anyone comes along and asks you, 'Is there a man here?' say no." Then Jael, wife of Heber, took a tent peg in one hand and a hammer in the other. She crept up on him, drove the tent peg through his temple into the ground while he was asleep from exhaustion, and he died. The "and he died" part really is kind of unnecessary. And then they sing this hymn of praise to Jael for what she did. It's pretty amazing. Michal, we read about Michal. Saul sends men to David's home. And they ask Michal, "Oh, where's David?" Well, first of all, she says he's sick. Well, then they finally go in the morning and she's got these dummies or whatever under the blankets. And they, "Oh, where's David?" "Well, he threatened to kill me if I didn't let him go, so I lowered him out the window." None of it true. Jonathan. And we know the story of Jonathan. He lies to his father about David going to Bethlehem for a feast. David was hiding behind a rock in the field the whole time. David lies when he feigns insanity. And then again, as we started off the teaching, when he lied to the high priest, Elimelech. How does this work? Because you know we're always looking for loopholes, aren't we? I know there's this, the Yetzer Hara inside of us thinking, "Yeah, I want to figure out, when can I lie? When can I get away with this? I can use this." And I don't see anybody dozing out there today. You're all like, right on the edge of your seat. This, I think, is the principle. And it's found in 2 Samuel chapter 22. 2 Samuel chapter 22. Chapter 22 is a psalm. It's a psalm of David. It was written after he escaped from Saul, yet it's found right at the very end of 2 Samuel. It's also found in the book of Psalms. It's Psalm 18. So 2 Samuel 22 and Psalm 18 are the same, with a few very tiny minor alterations. Listen to what it says. David says of God, You prove to be reliable to one who is blameless, but you prove to be deceptive to one who is perverse. Now, a lot of translations try to take that word deceptive and make it nice. Because, you know, our translators want God to behave. But God doesn't behave. It's like C.S. Lewis writes about Aslan. He is not a tame lion. And most of our theology and most of our denominational statements are an attempt to make God behave. But I love being in Messianic Judaism because he doesn't have to behave. God can be who he is. All I have to do is try to figure him out and learn about him. God doesn't have to submit to my theology about him. I must find a way of constructing theology in light of who God is. And that takes a lifetime. If your theological system is over and done with and complete, and you've dotted the last I and put a period in the last sentence, your theology is absolutely worthless. If your theology is complete, it's completely wrong. This is going to take you your entire life to develop your theology about God. And if you've quit developing your theology about God, then somewhere along the line you quit walking with him. It's my opinion, but it's right. The word deceptive is this word in Hebrew, titapal. It's only found here, only place. And you say, well, wait a minute, Grant, you said this psalm is also Psalm 18. Yeah, but the words changed there. Only here is this word found, and found in that way. And it's kind of interesting to look in the lexicons and to see what the Hebrew scholars say. They don't quite know what to do with this word. They don't know whether it's supposed to be the word patal, but misspelled. These two letters should be switched. If that's it, it means to twist something. A patil is a cord. We often read about cords, you know, in the high priest's clothing. You twist it, take the thread to twist them. So the word would be, you prove to be twisted to the one who is perverse. But that doesn't even sound as good as deceptive, does it? But they don't know it also comes from the word tafal, which means whitewash. It can mean saliva, it can mean whitewash. But that doesn't seem to make sense. But then we come to Psalm 18, verse 26. The wording in our translation is identical. You prove to be reliable to one who is blameless, but you prove to be deceptive to one who is perverse. But here the word deceptive is spelled differently. This time it is the word patal, pe, tav, lamed, which means twisted, like a cord, perverse, deceptive, backward. It's almost as if God is saying, I'm going to put this verse in the Bible twice. I'm going to be a little perverse about it. I'm going to misspell the word in one place just to throw you a curve. I don't know. But here's what I've come down with. And this is just my opinion. My theology is still developing. But it would seem that to a person who truly wants the truth, you give them the truth and nothing but. But when you're talking to a person who is invested in a lie, when a person is invested in a lie, then if the truth is harmful, don't give them the truth. In Proverbs, it talks about answer a fool according to his foolishness. It talks about mocking the mocker. And if a person is invested in a lie, they can't hear the truth anyway. They cannot hear the truth. There's no receptacle for truth. Saul, for example, was invested in a lie. Was David Saul's enemy? Just the opposite. He was devoted to Saul. He loved Saul. He fought for Saul. He loved Saul. He loved his family. He married his daughter and entered the covenant with his son. He was devoted to his king. But Saul couldn't see any of that truth. He was invested in a lie, and in Saul's mind, David's my enemy. He's turned Jonathan against me. He's turned my daughter Michal against me. He wants to destroy me. He wants to overthrow me. He wants to kill me. He wants to rob the throne of me. He had believed a lie. And so those around him gave him what he was invested in. You know, to a degree, I'm going to be very careful I say this, and please don't misunderstand or mishear what I'm trying to say. To a degree, Yeshua came to earth under false credentials. He was born in Bethlehem, but hardly anybody knew that. Because shortly after his birth, he was taken to Egypt for several years, and then when his family moved back, they lived in Nazareth. Everybody thought he was from Nazareth. Could any good thing come from Nazareth? That's why he comes to Bethlehem. He was from Nazareth. Well, actually, he was from Bethlehem, so why didn't he publicize it all? He was the Son of God. But he was raised in a home of two poor parents. A carpenter, a stonemason, whatever Joseph was. He didn't look like a king. He had no beauty or comeliness, Isaiah tells us, that we should desire him. He didn't wear royal garb. Wasn't born in a palace. And he was not the kind of Messiah Israel was looking for. It's almost like he came under false pretenses. But we know there's nothing false about him. There's no darkness in him. He's the light of the world. So what's going on here? And I think this is it. I think it's proven out by this principle in this verse. For those who really wanted the truth, no matter what, they knew Yeshua was the Messiah. They recognized him with the eyes of their spirit. And down in their hearts, this is the Son of God. When Yeshua asked his disciples, who do you say that I, the Son of Man, am? And Peter pipes up and he says, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. What did he tell him? Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you. In other words, Peter, you never arrived at that by looking at me. There's nothing in your common sense that told you that. And there's nothing about my appearance or anything about me that convinced you of that. Flesh and blood didn't do that, didn't reveal that to you, but the Spirit, my Father in heaven. Right? And that's the way it has to be with every follower of Yeshua. This is why I think we, as his followers, need to be very careful how we present him. You know, the world is attracted to cool dudes, so we try to dress Yeshua in cool dudism, so they'll accept him. And that's not right. And we want this conquering king, so we always try to present Yeshua as this buff, muscle-bound guy, you know. And he wasn't that. We need to quit dressing him up in the clothing and in the dress and in the fads of the world to just let him be who he is. And let the Spirit of God, let our Father in heaven reveal who he is to our hearts. And not try to use flesh and blood to convince people of who he is. Yeshua came so we would recognize him only for one reason. Because in our spirit we knew that we knew that we knew this is the anointed one. This is the light of the world. This is the Son of God. But Paul's the one exception. You know, he talks to him. Paul's the exception. God always has an exception to every rule. But you kind of get the principle in getting it here. I saw a hand up here. Was that you, Andy?
Yeah, John 7:17.
Excellent. You were looking at my notes, right? That's exactly one of the passages I have down. There's a few of them. You might want to write down the passages so you can look them up later. John 7:17 was the first one on my list. John 3:21. But the one who practices the truth comes to the light, so that it may be plainly evident that his deeds have been done in God. John 8:43. Yeshua asked his accusers, why don't you understand what I am saying? Answer, it's because you cannot accept my teaching. You're missing the internal equipment to receive truth. Your truth perceptors are welded shut. They're turned off. You can't listen to the radio signals that surround us without a radio turned on, right? There's radio and television and cell phone signals, all there, millions of them, coming through this room right now. But unless you have the proper receptor, you don't know it. And it's like some people, their receptors are broken or turned off, or they're just corroded from disuse. Who knows? But he says, why don't you understand what I'm saying? It's not because you're stupid. It's because you cannot accept my teaching. My teaching's truth. You don't have a perception for truth. You have no truth hook to hang truth on. Yes, Valerie.
Is it being truthful?
No. Because they kept coming after him. He didn't go to them. They came to him to challenge him. And so he responded to them. He didn't force them to understand. After his resurrection, I think some of them did. I think their truth detectors suddenly came to light for some of them. But here's an example that kind of maybe answers that question too. When he's on the cross, you know, when he was in the wilderness, Satan tested Yeshua with three testings. If you're the Son of God, turn these rocks into bread. If you're the Son of God, do this. If you're the Son of God. But there's a fourth temptation, and that's on the cross, where the Pharisees, the leaders, are looking at Yeshua hanging there and says, if you're the Son of God, come down. Was he the Son of God? Yes. Could he have come down? Yes. But he didn't. He allowed them to continue to believe that lie. Because what he was doing is more important than proving to them at that moment who he was. It's not an easy thing to understand. But Yeshua came to earth incognito, and God dwells in this world incognito now. He hides behind this physical creation, a creation that to a degree reveals him, but also hides him. It's a really complex kind of thing. And I see hands up everywhere. Jim, we'll start with you.
Godly man being protected by God from making mistakes, thinking he's honorably doing a ethical, moral principle approved of God. Would he be protected because he has proper motive for making mistakes?
That's a great question. The question is, would a man who thinks he's doing something morally right be protected by God when really it wasn't right, even though his motives were right? The answer to that is clearly no. No. In fact, let's go back to our list again. There are a couple here that weren't so blessed. Let's take Rachel and Jacob. It was a deception, and the deception worked. Jacob got the blessing, but he never saw his mother Rachel again. Why do I have Rachel there? Thank you. That was just a quiz, just a test. And I'm lying. Okay. Rebecca, thank you. He marries Rachel. But just as he deceived his father, what happened to Jacob later when he went to marry Rachel? He goes on the honeymoon, and in the morning, it ain't Rachel. It's her sister Leah. What he did to his father was done to him. He was not blessed by this deception. God used it. But God uses all of our errors anyway. If you don't believe that, we were just talking about this last night. If you don't believe that, think of Israel and their 40 years in the wilderness. Why did they spend 40 years in the wilderness? Out of sin and rebellion. And yet during those entire 40 years, God continued to lead them. With the cloud by day, with the fire by night, providing manna every day, providing the water, protecting them. This rebellious people for 40 years. Just because God's taking care of you and leading you doesn't mean you're not in sin. Let's take another example. Let's take this last one of David. David lies to the high priest Elimelech and says, Saul sent me on a secret mission. I had to leave so fast I couldn't even bring my sword to bring food. All lies. He should have leveled with Elimelech and told him what was going on. Because later on, it cost Elimelech his life. because when he's called before Saul, he tells Saul, I didn't know any of this. And then David himself confesses at the end of chapter 22, when Elimelech's one son, we'll start with verse 20, 1 Samuel 22, 20, one son of Ahimelech, son of Ahitub, his name was Abiathar, escaped and he fled to David. Abiathar told David that Saul had massacred the priest of Adonai. David said to Abiathar, I knew on that day that Doeg the Edomite was there, and that he would certainly inform Saul. I am responsible for every life of your father's house. And David was right. He shouldn't have lied to him. David got bread, he got a sword, and he escaped. But what a price his lie cost. Because Elimelech was not one invested in a lie. He's one invested in truth. David should have been truthful with him. Isaac was not a man invested in a lie. He is a man invested in truth. Rachel and Jacob should have appealed to him in truth. So here where these deceptions are not so blessed. You see? I think God protects us from a lot of accidental things. But our main protection is to be armed ahead of time with wisdom. That, this is the main thing. Thy word have I hid in my heart, that I might not sin against you. So we need to have this. Yeah. Yes, Sarah. Yes. Yeah, of course. Good point. Very good point. Both are good points. Yes. You know what? Another good point is that we're way over time. I hope, and please don't go away from here thinking, oh, I've got some excuses for lying. Let's get something straight. You don't have an excuse to lie. But there is a principle in Judaism that if a life is at stake, you can break any commandment except for immorality, adultery or immorality, blasphemy, or murder. Those three, you die before you commit any one of those three. But the Shabbat, what happens if your neighbor's donkey is in the ditch on the Sabbath? You break the Sabbath. You help him with his donkey. If you don't, you're actually sinning. And we can give lots of examples where saving a life is more important than anything. And in these cases, you're going to find with Rahab, Jael, Michal, Jonathan, David, you're going to find a life was at stake when they told their fibs. Okay? So I don't know if you're ever going to be in a place where a life is actually at stake. But we do have some patterns here that it would seem that not to deceive someone invested in a lie, not to deceive a murderer, would actually be a great error. I'm still figuring this out. I'm sharing with you. I'm taking a chance, going out on a limb, to share with you what I'm just thinking about, and I don't have it all set in stone yet. But I invite you to think about it with me and consider it with me. In the meantime, tell the truth, okay? Please tell the truth. Let's be honest. And it just occurred to me, we have not introduced the new faces yet. So what we're going to do, since we're so late, we're going to close in prayer. And across the hall, we have food. We always have food at our Torah services. And Dan, would you be so kind, as when people get over there, would you do the bracha over the food before we eat? Eat quickly, without within reason. And then when you're done, come on back in, and we're going to have some more music with words on the screen, and you can sing, and just have a great time of conversation and music. So we invite you to really enjoy yourself. So let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for this time together. And Lord, give us wisdom. I need it so much to understand these complex issues. But Father, I trust my brothers and sisters to study along with me and to delve into your word and to enhance our understanding of who you are. For you're not a simple God, but you are absolutely wonderful and great and good. We want to know you better. So Lord, reveal yourself to us more in our studies of your word. And we pray you'd help us to walk lives that are upright and righteous, lives like Yeshua's. And we ask it in his name. Amen.